of the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. First case of the morning, be Lou Bland et al. Versus Vitalis North America, Incorporated. Actually, we'll start with that. It'd be Mr. Robinson.
Yes.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm John Robinson. I represent the plaintiff retirees who are appellants here. This case is about promises made, promises broken. Promises were made by Fiat Alice North America, which we've called in this case FANA for an abbreviation, F-A-N-A. The promises were made by FANA through summary plan descriptions for an ERISA plan or plans in the 1970s and the 1980s. The promises that were made in the 70s and 80s were kept until February of 2001, when a successor corporation to FANA, Case New Holland Inc., breached those promises by increasing the premiums, by actually charging premiums, which consume at this point, as one can imagine, a large portion of the meager pension payments that are received by these retirees.
The retirees retired before, 1989? Is that right?
They did. Yes, they did, Your Honor. The retirees are now in their 70s and 80s. The retirees are all, so far as we know, qualified for and are receiving Medicare benefits, which reduce, of course, the Fiat Alice obligation to provide insurance. That was built into the plan documents in the beginning. This case is unique from any other that I think this court has reviewed in two respects. First, the plan documents contain very specific and clear vesting language on what I would call the three dimensions of vesting language. First, who provides it, who pays for it. Second, what are the coverages? Are they described? And third, is there a promise of lifetime benefit? And here, I submit that in the two governing plans, in effect, these four or five plan documents really boil down to two that control. One for, these are all non-union employees, one for hourly employees who are already retired, and the other one is for retired salaried employees. All three dimensions of vesting language is covered in those SPDs, in those summary plan descriptions. But
the 78 plan, is that the language that's similar to the 76? There's some deviation there, isn't there?
Judge, the 78 plan is a plan that was issued to active employees while they were active before they retired. That plan, after those employees retired, they received a summary plan description for retired employees. And that's the one which we believe controls. That one confirms the benefits. And if you look at those, you'll see that the some 8 or 9 pages of specific descriptions of plan coverages are absolutely identical for both. The only thing really different about the SPD for retired employees is that it is far more confirmatory, it is far stronger, and it uses language such as these benefits will remain in effect as long as you or your surviving spouse are living. The other part of this, though, that I want to point out that is unique in this case, and I don't think it's been seen by this court before, is the fact that there is no reservation of rights clause anywhere. And the plan documents don't contain any procedure even, as is suggested, if not required by ERISA, to provide a mechanism or a procedure to make amendments. There's nothing there. Now, the parties agree that the controlling documents are the summary plan descriptions. There are no other special contracts that either party has alleged here. And there are no original plan documents. We're not talking about special deals between the insurance company and FANA. We're just talking about these documents that are attached to the complaint.
Now, it would not be a problem, I guess, maybe in your view, if whatever in 2001, the last change that you're talking
about? 2001, Your Honor, was the change that charged these older retirees premiums which consume their small pension payments.
From that point forward, the plan gave, I guess we'll call it substantially less, or at least less benefits for future retirees. That change would be, I guess, appropriate henceforth. Is that it? You're saying the people already retired could be getting a lot better benefits than those who retire later, the early retirees.
I think I agree with Your Honor. Our position has never been that we believe that an employer, whether it's FANA or anyone else, cannot change an ERISA plan for active employees before they retire. Our position in this case is, however, that, as is the case here, all of these putative class members retired before 1989, and it was only in 1989, that was the first time that FANA ever inserted a reservation of rights clause in any summary plan description. These people all retired before that time. And our view is, while they could amend, as they did for those active employees, they can't amend and take away something they have already given. And I believe this court and several of the other circuits, most if not all of the circuits, have ruled in that way. The other thing that's unique about this case is that in 1984, FANA generated internal documents which are in dispute and which we've asked the court to look at conditionally in this case, because they're now sealed. We believe that portions of those documents, which we've called the Onion Solution documents, because that's the name that FANA and their attorneys gave them, those documents make this case unique also, because those documents absolutely confirm that FANA knew these benefits were vested in 1984. They were advised that way, and the documents suggest that they knew it anyway. Nevertheless, those same documents that we've pointed out here in our brief and reply brief indicate that despite that, FANA was back then looking at options to reduce their costs. Could we do that? Now, they didn't do it, thank God, until 2001. But that is, if our position on that, Your Honors, is that if the court finds that rather than being unambiguous language, which we think it is, I'm getting ahead of myself here, but we think that the result
should... If it's unambiguous, why would you have to rely on any of
this? You wouldn't. Yeah. You wouldn't. And that's why I say, Judge, that our request for looking at those documents is conditional. We don't get to those documents as extrinsic evidence if this court reverses and sends it back for a judgment for the plaintiffs, which I think is what should be done.
Your position is that these documents are admissible because they don't pertain to the administration of the trust? Is that?
That's one of the reasons, Your Honor. They do not pertain to administration. Now, they do talk about... And the argument from the other, from FANA, is that, well, these deal only with modification, termination of a plan. Well, they do deal with that, but portions of these also deal with the vested status of these benefits. And I submit that because of the special relationship that FANA had, it had an employee benefits committee, much like most employers do when they're administering these plans. In fact, Mr. Bland was a member of that committee. He was wearing two hats, one, I guess, as an administrator for the for the plan and also then one as an employee of FANA. But nevertheless, this fiduciary relationship that exists between FANA and its Employee Benefits Committee and the beneficiaries, who are the retirees now, we believe creates an obligation for the company to tell the truth about the status, the vested status in this case, of these benefit plans. The second reason we believe that these are admissible is because if you look at the Onion Solution documents, the portions of them clearly indicate that they had larceny in their heart because they were planning to deceive these employees. They were planning, who are now retirees, they were planning to tell them that if you don't accept reductions in what we know are vested benefits, we're going to tell you we're going to file for bankruptcy. We submit that that's the same kind of thing that the U.S. Supreme Court was talking about in the Verity versus Howe Corporation case. And this court has talked about it in a number of cases, that it is a violation of fiduciary duty for an employer to lie to its employees or its retirees.
How many are, let's just take the whole, between 77 and 89, how many retirees are involved here?
Your Honor, there has been attrition, but I believe at and this is purely an estimate, I would say it's probably between 1,000 and 1,200, but only FANA would know because they have the records.
And the other thing is that there are, at least there's some distinction made between, you know, just the 1977 group, then 1978 to 85, I think, and they're divided up. And you're saying they're all in the same boat regardless.
Yes, Your Honor, and I say that, and that's what the district court did. The district court accepted the argument that was made by FANA that this 1978 SPD, which on its face says it's for active employees, that it somehow abrogates the SPD for retired salaried employees, and that SPD says on its face this is for retired salaried employees, and at the bottom at a postscript it says for those retired salaried employees who retired, as in a past tense manner, for those who retired after December 31 of 1976, in other words, from then on. Our position is, just as in the Vallone case, which this court decided July 15, 2004, last summer, an employer has the right, and often does, issue more than one summary plan description covering the same people. That those summary plan descriptions describe the identical benefits, coverages. They make the promise that they're going to be paid for by the company, and they have violated. We believe that if the court below had had the benefit of this court's decision in Vallone, that we wouldn't be here today, because under Vallone, even though the facts are distinguishable, there would be the court would have entered a judgment on the 12C motion in favor of the plaintiffs.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Casserari?
May it please the court. My name is Mark Casserari. I am one of the attorneys for the defendants in this case, and I want to address my comments to the themes in our brief, which I think sets forth our position clearly, and respond to some of Mr. Robinson's points. I will, by way of introduction, point out to the court, just in summary, that in 2001, when Case New Holland established an amended benefit plan for the retirees covered by this lawsuit, Case New Holland did not terminate any benefits, rather modified them for cost-sharing purposes. So this is not a case like others, for example, the Bidlack case, where the issue was whether the termination of benefits would violate ERISA and the plan documents. This is a case where cost-sharing modifications are implemented for these plaintiff retirees and others. The other point...
How much was the co-payment or whatever it is increased here in 2001?
Correct. It did. That's
yeah, but what was the extent of the increase?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know exactly. I can say this, that this case comes to the court on cross motions for judgment on the pleadings, 12C motions for judgment on the pleadings. Both parties here have stated that the plan language is unambiguous and cross move for judgment on the pleadings. Under that analysis, the plan documents and the allegations in the complaint are accepted as true. I can also tell the court that there is no allegation in the amended complaint on which the cross 12C motions are based that the increase in the premium or the other changes to the levels of benefits to impose, for example, network procedures, there is no allegation that those changes were inconsistent with the market, were unreasonable in light of the market, were somehow, by their own nature, totally disconnected from cost sharing going on in the market as to constitute, in effect, the termination of the plan. So the allegations of the complaint, which are accepted as true, I think fairly state that the changes were consistent with the healthcare marketplace.
I didn't understand your last comment.
Well, Your Honor, you asked what the increase was. I don't know.
I'm just trying to generally discover what the impact on these employees was.
The impact on the employees comes from the amended complaint allegations, and there's nothing in the amended complaint that says that this impact was anything other than any other cost-sharing methods that have taken place over the years for other retirees. That's the best way to answer your question.
Cautionary? Did you say?
Cost-sharing.
Cost-sharing. Yeah. Thank you.
Now,
I don't quite understand that. I mean, it's consistent with you increase the copay or whatever you call it, but it's consistent with something else, which I don't quite understand.
Well, Your Honor, I think the point is that the complaint doesn't say what the specific premium increase was, so I'm bound by it. What the complaint challenges, though, is the right of the defendant company to make any changes. The allegation of the complaint is that the plan documents at issue prohibited any change, any possible change to these benefit levels. So the plaintiffs argued before the court that there were promises, but that really begs the question. The question is, before this court, whether these plan documents indeed did vest benefits, did promise benefit levels that could not change for the lives of the retirees. That's the issue before the court. And the backdrop to that issue is ERISA. And in this court's decision in Vallone, the court said that because these plans are ERISA plans, it is the burden of the plaintiffs to show a clear and express promise not to change benefit levels in any respect. And the issue before the court is whether there is that clear and express promise in the plan documents.
Well, now, when you say that not to change, because part of your argument is that coverage is flexible. Coverage means, yeah, they're going to be covered, but not necessarily by the same amount or maybe even for the same length of time. I'm not clear exactly how that works, just even on the pleadings. What is your position as far as the language as stated in either guaranteeing or not guaranteeing that they'll have a certain level or at least coverage for the rest of their life?
Well, for example, in the 1977 plan document, that plan document talks about providing for the retirees coverage, small c, benefits, small b. And the 2001 changes still provide coverage, small c, benefits, small b. So there's no violation of any promise. There's no clear and express language in that plan document that says that we are providing you a defined benefit. As in Vallone, for example, there were HRA accounts, which were health allowance accounts. And in that case, there was a defined benefit that was promised, so much in money a month that was being promised. Now, the court held in Vallone that there was no violation of the promise because of a reservation of rights. That was expressly in the plan documents. In this case, we don't have the kind of defined benefit promise that existed in Vallone, and for that reason, there's no violation of the plan documents allowing coverage small c and benefits small b. And that's why for the 77 plan, the district court was right that the plaintiffs cannot show, given this plan language, a clear and express promise to lock in defined benefit levels.
Over a period of time, is the variable that you would at least express as being available the copayment? Because if you say in 1977 you're going to get X dollars, in 2005 that X dollars may be minimal if you had the same amount. So there has to be some measure of growth, I would think, if that's so the copay is the only thing that moves up underneath that. I don't know exactly the, and I don't know anything about the details of these plans, but I'm trying to get focused on what you think can and can't happen.
Well, I think that as for what can or can't happen, really is a function of the allegations in the amended complaint.
Okay.
That's how I would see the case here. So since we're at cross motions under 12C, take the allegations as true, the complaint takes the position that there can be no change to the benefit levels, no change whatsoever. And the complaint does not take the position that a certain change was unreasonable or was too high or was inconsistent with industry practice, for example. The complaint says no change because the plans promised no change. So the issue before the court, it's a narrow one. It is, do these plans promise no change in benefit levels? And I've just stated why I think the district court got it right, because there was no defined benefit level in the plan. There was only vague terms about coverage. We leave for another day the question of how much change the employer could make consistent with the representations in the summary plan description. We leave that for another day because the issue before this court is, could the employer make any change? And since there's nothing prohibiting a change, the employer could.
If you had a capital C and a capital B, you get a different result, though.
Well, you might. Your Honor, you would get for the 77 plan, those who retired under the 77 plan, you would get a different result if the plan said, for your lifetime, you are entitled to a defined benefit as follows. Pension plans have defined benefits, $300 a month. Health allowances, like in the Vallone case, have a defined benefit, $100 a month. A specific level of benefits. It doesn't say that. Council talked about the integration between the 77 plan and the 78 plan, and I think it's important to note that those plans are distinct, and the district court got that right. In the amended complaint, if you look at the claim, the amended complaint itself treats the 78 plan as a standalone plan in the claim for relief. It is only in the arguments in these briefs that it's come out that they're somehow integrated together. And the 78 plan uses words like the plan shall continue, will continue. And we've cited cases to the court saying that's not the kind of clear and express language that allows for the vesting of retiree medical benefits. So under the 78 plan, there is no vesting. And that leaves us with the 78 hourly plans. The 78 hourly plans are like the 78 salary plan, and in that they don't provide for any durational benefits. They don't contain the word lifetime, and for that reason, they're just like the 78 salary plan. The 78 salary plan doesn't have the word lifetime, and the benefits did not vest. Council brought up the absence of an express reservation of rights clause as if to say to this court that's somehow makes the case unique. In the Vallone case in footnote 8, the court already answered that question. The court said that the absence of a reservation of rights clause does not prohibit an employer from making a change. So the argument we hear over and over again, there's no express reservation of rights, is really settled by Vallone. And under ERISA, an employer has a reserved right to make changes to benefit plans. The employer doesn't have to expressly state that. It's reserved, and that's what Vallone says. In response to Judge Cudahy's comment about the specific levels, I would cite the court to a comment in the Deal case where the court said, and I can't remember precisely, but it was something like, we cast a cold eye on a claim that an employer cannot make any change to benefit levels by virtue of benefit plans drafted 20 years previously. That's what the court said in Deal. And that comment really applies to this case. It's an odd thing for an employer to make that sort of promise. And what ERISA says, what Vallone says by using the clear and express language is that ERISA is going to require clear and express statements, and they don't exist in these plans. Now, Deal is a different case because...
Of course, in 1976 and 78, this issue never entered anybody's head, did it? That these benefits would have to be changed in any respect? We started dealing in legal fiction here, aren't we?
Well, Your Honor, that what that says is that there was no clear and express intent to vest the benefits.
Could be, could be.
I want to make just a short comment about the documents that are under seal. I think Judge Evans made the point that the court need not reach that issue since the parties have cross-moved for judgments on the pleadings, which, of course, indicates that they both think the language is unambiguous, so therefore you don't get into extrinsic evidence. But I will say that the standard for review of a district court's ruling on privileged documents is that the plaintiff must show clear error in the decision. And in all the papers filed by the plaintiffs in this case, there is no recognition of that standard. There is no citation of specific documents to show an exception, a fiduciary exception, for example, to the attorney-client privilege. And I think the court got it right that these documents concern the administration of a plan in the sense of modification or termination of benefits. Okay. There is no quoting of certain privileged documents to specifically identify to the court where the clear error is. Instead, what the plaintiffs do is simply say, we want the court to look at the documents. We think they prove our case. Because the plaintiffs have not shown clear error, that's a reason why there's no reason to overturn the privilege ruling of the court. And furthermore, these documents do not say what the plaintiffs say. So with all those points in mind, Your Honor, and the ones set forth in our brief, it's our position that the district court exactly got this case right, and this court should affirm.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Robinson?
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 2.5 minutes.
Thank you. Now, very briefly, then.
Yes. Counsel's correct that the complaint does not allege that the changes, the increases, were done, say, to mask, to cover up that they wanted to get rid of the plan in its entirety. I mean, we could have a situation where premiums were raised so astronomically that the plan would be de facto defunct. But there's no claim here that in the complaint that the copays were increased to such a level that was inconsistent with whatever the market bears in 2001 or so.
That representation by the defendants is simply not true. The complaint alleges a contract. Our first claim alleges an ERISA contract. And I have, as I said in my initial remarks, this case, more than any other, represents a situation where the summary plan descriptions contain all three dimensions of vesting language. It says the company will provide basic medical and dental as to salaried retirees at their cost, zero. And as to retire...
And that's your argument, is that... It's correctly stated that there can be no change.
Absolutely,
not
Judge.
Not a dollar.
Absolutely, because they promised that it would be for nothing. And if you were to extend the defendant's arguments to its logical extreme, they could provide reduced benefits down to, let's say, a dollar per month, regardless of what the cost to the retiree was, and charge a $100 premium. If the court will look at the summary plan descriptions, and I also would respond. Counsel said that the word lifetime is not used in these summary plan descriptions. We have abstracted at our short appendix, pages 36 to 38, the key language from these controlling summary plan descriptions. And they use the word lifetime, or for the rest of your life, or until death. And I don't think anything could be more clear. Under Vallone, this case, the court should reverse and instruct a judgment for the plaintiffs here, because under Vallone, there is clear and express language that touches cost, coverages, and lifetime, and there are no restrictions reserved to amend at all. This is a unique case in that respect. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks very much to both counsel. This case will be taken under